Welcome to this edition of the Pepperdine People Podcast. I'm your host, Rick Gibson. This series captures some of the outstanding learning and outreach opportunities available here at Pepperdine. Each episode features interviews with exceptional members of our community and the special people who visit our campus.
This is Ted Garcia with the Pepperdine Public Relations and News Department, and we're here today with Jim West, who is the president and CEO of Futures for Children in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Thank you for being with us.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you, Ted.
You have a fascinating background. You're Cheyenne. Right. And for people who aren't too familiar with I know in Texas and Oklahoma, people are a lot more familiar with the Indian tribes. Tell me about Cheyenne.
The Cheyenne people are Plains people, Plains Indian people. People might be familiar with Dances with Wolves, which was about the Lakota Sioux. The Lakota were allies of ours, so we were a horse culture. We were a buffalo people, if you will. The buffalo was our economy. It's what we ate. It's what we – our robes were made out of. Our teepees were made out of buffalo hides. We were semi-nomadic, so we covered a range of area east of the Rocky Mountains in Colorado, Wyoming, part of the Dakotas and Nebraska. But there are other tribes who had moved through the, you know, the same area. So one of the important points to make about Indian people is that there are many different tribes and many different cultures, many different spiritual ways of life. And so when I describe our way of life, today there are 568 federally recognized tribes. And it's important to understand that mine is one example of a culture that was here, but there were many, you know, many other cultures.
I understand here. You're involved in Wounded Knee.
I was a negotiator, yes, okay. At Wounded Knee.
Tell me about that.
Well, I was ordained with the American Baptist Churches as a community organizer, and then I was commissioned to work with the National Council of Churches and the Interreligious Foundation for Community Organization, which were groups that worked trying to help in political development and economic development using resources of the church. So I worked with organizers both in the urban area, such as many people know about the American Indian Movement, AIM, but I also worked with organizers in the tribal nation context on what's called reservations. And those are two very different worlds. Half of our population is now in off-reservation, as we say. Los Angeles, for instance, has a huge population of Indians, many who came in the relocation program. So the Indian people in the urban setting have grown up as a minority, you know, within that culture, with institutions that oftentimes were not meeting their needs. And that was the dynamic of empowerment, really, that was brought out of the urban experience in the 70s. And organizers on the other hand, in a tribal nation setting, are working to empower the government that's growing and struggling, the economy, the political dynamics of a tribal nation. And so the American Indian Movement was attempting to highlight broken treaties that had happened throughout the history, especially in Minnesota and South Dakota. And so they were attempting to highlight that and came into the Pine Ridge Sioux Reservation and ended up declaring the Oglala Sioux Nation there in the Wounded Knee province of Pine Ridge. Now, that's the Oglala Sioux Nation's nation, their boundaries are the Oglala Sioux Nation. And there was a mixture of tribes that were involved in the takeover at Wounded Knee and a fairly militant government at that time. And so a conflict broke out, really, between Wounded Knee started as an Indian against Indian conflict. Then because of the Major Crimes Act, the federal government was involved They came in eventually with half tracks and gunboats, and I mean, it was not the FBI and the U.S. Marshals as most people would recognize them. And there was a small war, if you will, in 1973 on the Pine Ridge Reservation. And I was actually in school at the time, but I'd worked with organizers. I was in graduate school, but they asked me, because I'd worked with both urban and reservation organizers, to just work with communication. It was during the time in March when there was heavy fighting because the negotiating team had broken down, a formal one. And my task was just to get communication flowing again amongst the three parties.
What was that like?
It was an experience that when you're in it, it's very difficult to understand that the rest of the world is going on. And even as I flew out of Rapid City, became almost dreamlike. It was almost like a nightmare. You couldn't believe that kind of fighting. It was a small war happening in the midst of our country. And it was very difficult to connect that probably to reality as we knew it even at that time in the U.S.
So in the bigger picture, Vietnam was happening.
Yes.
And then this – almost like a small kind of microcosm or something was happening at this time. Mm-hmm. So I guess it seems like the country was going through a lot at that time and you were so young. That must have been a lot of responsibility for you.
Yeah, my wife points out I think I was 26 years old, you know, at the time I negotiated it at Wounded Knee. And it's probably good. You know, I was young enough to be crazy enough to even volunteer to do it. You know, but it was a very difficult experience because of the philosophical conflict that it involved, you know, mm-hmm. amongst Indian people. I know that Tom Capra, his father was Frank Capra, mm-hmm. It's a Wonderful Life, and he worked with, I believe, NBC at the time. He worked with most of the stations through his career, not stations, but networks.
Right.
And we had the occasion to be together almost exactly 25 years after Wounded Knee. He had been there. I had been there as a negotiator. As Tom put it, you know, you were there getting shot at and I was there taking pictures of it. But Tom and I had experienced that, and I had never been able to characterize in my mind what Wounded Knee was about. It certainly did not seem to accomplish a great deal except bringing the awareness to people of Indian issues. And I remember the moment that he asked me, you know, Jim, what was that about? And I was able 25 years later mm-hmm. just to say to Tom, someone that I knew who had been through that experience, and I just said, Tom, it was about our pain as American Indian people. And I think in many ways that was the essence of what Wounded Knee was about.
Now, you grew up in Oklahoma, correct?
Right.
What part?
I grew up – our land as Cheyennes is in western Oklahoma.
Okay.
I grew up in the northeast part. My father taught art. He got the first Master's of Fine Arts degree that OU gave. Oklahoma University
wow.
gave to an Indian, and taught in a mission school, an American Baptist Junior College in Muskogee, Oklahoma, on the northeast side of the state. So I had a very unique bringing up during the 40s and 50s. At that time, most tribes were, I don't want to say just parochial, but they, you know, they were contained. Their life was within their own tribe, and there wasn't too much intertribal mixture except at Bacone College.
Mm-hmm.
It was a little United Nations of Indians. There were 70 different tribes usually represented at Bacone in a given year. Now, those tribes would come. They'd have an intertribal experience, and they'd go back usually to their reservations, to their people. My brother and I grew up in that atmosphere. I grew up there for 16 years. So I grew up in the context of many tribes, learning the different ways and the nuances of the different cultures, and ended up in my career working with about 130 different Indian tribes. And I think that that experience at Bacon College made it possible in my career to work with many different American Indian peoples.
Was it a conscious effort to always work with Indian tribes, or did you think, you know what, I'm going to leave the tribe and become a doctor or a rocket scientist, or was that always that's near and dear to your heart?
No, I think that's been a part of who I am. My mother, who was non-Indian, came to Bacon as a missionary to serve Indians. My father got his degree and served Indian people. And so Rick and I had another unique aspect to our bringing up, and that is an experience that probably more non-Indians had at the time, and that is just the expectation that we would get an education. I mean, it wasn't even, you know, I mean, they were poor, they worked, they got through their education, so we had no excuse but to do the same. And I think they also, there was an expectation that that education would help us understand the realities of the world, but as it might be put, that also understand how the world should be and that we should be of service and that we should. So I think from the very beginning, I remember my choice to go to seminary was actually a politically conscious choice.
Interesting. Well, you have been of service also because of Futures for Children.
Yes.
So what is that about? I know it's Albuquerque-based. Tell me about that.
Futures has 141 sites among the Pueblo people in New Mexico, the Navajo people who are primarily in Arizona but also in New Mexico, and the Hopi people. And so we work – we're probably one of the few private organizations that has significant infrastructure on reservations because we – don't receive federal money. We're basically privately funded. We're 501c3. Mm-hmm. We have three programs, a mentoring program that that brings in mentors from all over the United States. At a recent event that we had, Olivia Redhorse, whose origins are from the Four Corners area out near Monument Valley, pretty far out in the middle of nowhere, who graduated from New Mexico State University and who is working in the, at a NASA facility at White Sands, New Mexico now, spoke about the relationship she'd had with her mentors who are from here in San Marino, California, and had been her mentors since she was in kindergarten and who had, through a distance mentoring process, encouraged her in her schooling, encouraged her to be the first one from her family to go to college, and had just supported her, you know, through that whole process. And she had tried to take her skills and work at Navajo, but there wasn't the infrastructure there that she was able to, so she's working now at White Sands. So that mentoring process has a long history. It's 40 years that it's been a part of Futures for Children, some wonderful stories. Our youth leadership program, which now has over 1,000 kids in it, has curriculums for high school, mid-school and elementary school. And it works with some standard youth leadership forms in the sense that it's working with self-esteem, self-image, organizational theory, leadership skills. But there's an aspect of it that's very close to our self-help philosophy, and that is that each semester the students in that curriculum have to conceive of a project, deliver the project. Mm-hmm. And so it's about community service as well. And we have found, I'm pretty sure as our statistics come together on that program, that because of their involvement in youth leadership, kids will do better academically. And our third program is called Families in Action. It's trying to make – trying to help our parents be more involved on the reservation, be more proactive in the education, not only of their child but in the system that's there. So we're working against some statistics nationally in which almost 65% of American Indian children nationally do not make it through high school, drop out, or they may get a GED later, but they drop out in their first effort. Over the last 7 years, 95% of the kids in our program have either been promoted to the next grade level, whether that's grade school or mid school, or have graduated. And I'm very excited and proud of that. So consequently, they're now – we've been K through 12 for 40 years, but they're now pulling us into post-secondary because as they're successful in high school, then they start looking beyond that. So nationally, I think our kids only go to college about 17%, and they hit some horrible statistics. 93% of them will not make it through college on their first try. 62% will fall out in the first year. But our kids are going – are trying for college, and it may be college. It may be – it's mainly college, but some vo-tech, some art school, you know, some other things. But they're going at between 35 and 38%. So they're doubling the number nationally, you know, that are trying to go on into post-secondary.
So you're really accomplishing something here.
We feel like we are, yeah, and I'm very excited about that. I'm inspired by these kids. You know, it's nice at my age to have these young kids who are inspiring me. I mean, people talk about me being a model for them, but I've got to say they inspire me on a daily basis. So it's a wonderful place to be.
So what's next for you?
I would like to put a financial base under Futures for Children. We've had to raise our budget from scratch every year. We're right now with the board trying to looking at the feasibility of trying to create some endowment, trying to so that there'd be some of that operational budget that we would not that we would not have to raise every year. So we're looking at that, studying that. I'd like to – that would be one part of something I'd like to do before I leave Futures. The second thing I'd like to do is really help us begin to launch some post-secondary program because that hasn't been a part of our programmatic base, but we're beginning to do that. So it'd be nice to really see us go to the next level with these young American Indian people who are inspired to do that.
So. Well, with someone like you at the helm, I'm sure you can.
Well, thank you. We'll give it our best shot.
And best of luck to you.
Thank you very much, Ted. I appreciate it.
We've been talking to Jim West, President and CEO of Futures for Children in Albuquerque. Thanks again. I am Ted Garcia from the Pepperdine Public Relations and News Department. Thanks for listening.